Welcome to Nattering with the Knights, North Anglia International School Hong Kong's PE department, talking about sport, physical activity, health, and a host of other topics.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Nattering with the Knights with me, Mr. Erskine. This week my role is reversed and I become the interviewee, with Miss Jones asking the questions about my experience in Ethiopia, helping raise lots of money for young people to get involved in football. So get up, get active, get the earphones in, and I look forward to hearing your feedback from the episode.
Hello and welcome back to Nattering with the Knights. This week, I sit down with our usual host, Mr. Erskine, as we talk about some of his work in Ethiopia. His project involves raising money and awareness for young people in the town of Bishoftu, just outside of Addis Ababa, the capital, to help get them involved in football. The story, which has seen him visit the town three times in the past 7 years, has evolved since the project started in 2013, and he has managed to raise £15,000, or HK$150,000, to help various youngsters get involved in football. The level of commitment that Mr. Erskine has shown to his project is impressive. While there have been a number of obstacles over the past few years, he has maintained personal monthly donations to pay the wages of the head football coach of the group. He remains in regular contact with the group and provides support and financial assistance where possible. Welcome, Mr. Erskine.
Hello.
Right, well, let's get this story started. What was the backstory to wanting to get involved in charity work?
So at the time, I was living in the Middle East, Kuwait specifically, which is a very kind of rich environment. And I was working in a school where lots of our young people were very, very fortunate, with lots of money. And I went through a little bit of a frustrating period where I wanted to work with some young people who were maybe a little bit more grateful. And that's not saying that all the people I worked with weren't grateful for my time, but I just felt that I wanted to work with people that were maybe less fortunate. And that kind of teed me up to looking into some charity work. I just wanted to do something for free, you know, and because, you know, at the time we were earning very good money in the Middle East, and I thought it was quite good to maybe give something back. It was just my time. So I looked into some different options, and I was also aware that Kuwait was a very good place to fundraise. Lots of our teachers had similar feelings about helping, you know, less fortunate young people around the world, but they also had very good contracts and not many things to spend their money on. So it actually was a really good place to try and drum up some fundraising. And that was kind of the starting point, really.
So from that point of figuring out that you wanted to do some charity work, how did you start working with the charity in Ethiopia?
So I looked at a couple of options and did my research. But Ethiopia, first and foremost, was picked on the basis it was a direct flight from Kuwait. Meaning I could be there in 4 hours, and obviously I had these high and mighty ideas of getting lots of equipment into the country, and therefore again I just thought a direct flight would make that process a little bit easier. When I then narrowed it down to Ethiopia, I kind of looked at a couple of different options, and Link Ethiopia came up. It was predominantly an education based charity, so they generally put their volunteers into schools and help teach English. Now, obviously, while I was able to do that, I didn't feel that was going to get the best out of me. So I got in touch with them and suggested that I could maybe better off teaching some PE classes or doing some football coaching. And they were really interested at that different avenue because obviously I would still be teaching it through English. And that was how the process started, and we kind of got the whole thing going. So the real focus and the pivot point was that it was basically a chance to get more underprivileged young people playing football in an organised and structured way, which hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about as the podcast goes on.
Okay, so you've decided on Ethiopia. You're going to work with Link Ethiopia and potentially raise or get more children involved, like through PE and football. How do you then, living in a country like Kuwait, begin to prepare for your first trip to Ethiopia?
Well, bearing in mind I didn't really know what I was fully letting myself in for, apart from I knew I was going for 2 weeks to this little town called Bishoftu, which has since become one of my fondest memories of going back to Ethiopia. So I knew that fundraising was an important part of it. As being a volunteer for the charity, they requested that you, I I can't remember the exact sum of money that you were asked to try and raise, but it wasn't a huge amount, because again, lots of the people that would volunteer are maybe young students in the UK, and they maybe don't have the capacity to raise a lot. So let's say, for argument's sake, it's £500. And so I knew that that was a starting point, and I had to therefore look into some ways I was going to create that fundraising, but also get people in Kuwait involved in some charitable acts, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. So I set up a Just Giving page, and my first kind of way of getting people to donate was I set myself up to complete and hopefully be competitive in the Abu Dhabi Triathlon, which was back in 2013, which at the time was only my second ever triathlon. And I also said I would personally match the donation total until the day that I flew to Ethiopia. So I think the triathlon was in the March time. I was flying to Ethiopia in the June, so I had a 3-month window. And I also had a lot of friends at home that liked the sound of this, mainly me being out of pocket. So they started throwing donations in right at the last minute, and it actually went up to £1,000, 10,000 Hong Kong dollars, and therefore I had to stick to my word and match the donation. So while that had me out of pocket, if you like, it was definitely worth it. I also got pupils at the school involved at the time that we were working at. I asked them to donate their old football kit, tops, boots, shorts, anything at all. But given the kind of affluent nature of the school, the standard and the quality of the kit I was receiving was unbelievable. There was football boots coming in that had been worn once, and they were the brand new Nike Vapors, you know, probably worth $1,000 Hong Kong, and the kids were just bringing them in and going, "There you go, sir, take these with you." And I was like, right, it wasn't this, like when I donate stuff to charity, it's stuff that's, you know, potentially been run down and used. Some of the stuff was pretty much brand new, so it was unbelievable what we were going to be able to bring over. I then shipped all that over before I actually flew, which is another story in itself. But I actually sent over about 50 kilograms of boxes with football kits and boots. And then I also took a load of stuff in my own luggage, which was footballs and pop-up goals from Decathlon, which is actually obviously here. It was very big in Kuwait. So that was the kind of preparation work that I put in before I actually got there.
It sounds like the students at your previous school really invested in your project by volunteering to donate such, well, what would be deemed as very worthy items, because every kid loves a football kit. You are now, you know, you've got your items that you're going to donate. You've been raising your money. You're about to head off to Bishoftu. Can you talk us through what the experience was like on your first visit to Bishoftu?
A little bit of a crazy first experience in the airport. My dad has always taught me to be wary in countries that you've never been before, to always be on your guard. And it's always related to some horror stories about passports being taken and, you know, pickpockets, etc. And so after a really strange ordeal with tax, first I was in there for about 2 hours, getting taxed on the footballs that I brought over from Decathlon, which started off in this process of all the various hurdles that I would experience in Ethiopia, in basically trying to help young people. I was having to pay and pay and pay to various people that I didn't agree should have been paid. But that's another story. I also then was met by Habtamu, who was the Link Ethiopia member of staff. But I didn't know who was going to be collecting me. I just knew there was somebody. So he didn't have a sign. I didn't know who he was. And he obviously knew who I was because I was the only Westerner on the flight. And so he came over with this a flower arrangement thing that put around my neck. And obviously it was like the Ethiopian way of greeting people is like a handshake and a shoulder tap together. And so it was almost like he was coming in for this hug. And I literally didn't even know if this was the guy that was meant to be picking me up. So I was very, you could say I was passive aggressive. I was like, "Whoa, who are you? Like, I got wanting to see some ID or something." And it was like, you know, fortunately me and Habtamu have a very good relationship. But that first couple of minutes was bizarre because I wasn't convinced that he was actually the person that was meant to be taking me. Then I obviously had all this luggage. And again, naive, very naive. I'd just come from the Middle East where you want something, you want to get from A to B, you pick up the phone, you flag down a car, and you get there. And so I had all these bags, and I just assumed that, you know, that the charity was relatively close to the airport, and I would therefore be throwing my bags into the boot of a car and we would be getting to the to the location. And we weren't. That wasn't the way it was done. We were going to take 3 taxis to get to the office, which is where I was going to be sleeping for the next 2 weeks. But when I say taxis, they're like more like minibuses. It's what a taxi in Ethiopia is described as. And they fill it to the brim. So if there's 14 seats in the bus, you're probably going to find there's more like 18 people in the bus. And obviously I had all this luggage. Like I'm talking, I had 4 massive hold-alls of kit that I couldn't even carry myself. I needed a trolley. You weren't allowed the trolley outside the airport. The taxi was a 15-minute walk away. So before you know it, there's these 2 random kids are walking with my bag on their head. Obviously, they want some money to do that job, and that was fine. But literally, we took 3 separate taxis to get back to the office. And by the time I got there, I was absolutely exhausted. And it was such a bizarre start to the journey, but one that I still remember very fondly. And then, yeah, the next 2 weeks kind of captured my heart. Like I was so exhausted from this journey from the airport and the whole surreal nature of the thing. I woke up, I had a quick nap in my new bed at the back of the office, where there was 5 members of the charity working at the same time. I woke up from this nap and I could hear Habtami was like, you know, oh, calm, come through here. And I walked through and I look out the window, and there was, in the garden of this office, there was about 20 kids sat there. And I was really confused. I was like, what are all these kids doing here? And he's like, oh, they're here to see you. And I went, how? And he goes, because there's been word spread that we've got a coach coming over to coach football, and these are going to be some of the kids you're going to be working with. And they were basically all came up, shook my hand. They were, my biblical name in Ethiopia is Caleb. So that's what they were calling me. And I was just amazed at the fact that they'd sat in complete silence outside the building waiting for me to wake up. They'd all come out just to see me as if I was some like mythical high-quality football coach. it was a really bizarre experience, but one that really made me think, wow, these guys are so grateful that I'm here to try and do something for them. So I started coaching the next day. It was a rough surface to play on in terms of it was in a private school, actually, but the surface was not exactly accommodating to good quality football. It was probably, like you would describe it, as maybe a dirt floor. So already I lost 2 footballs that first day. They deflated because it, like, little kind of bits off of like a bush got stuck in the ball, and they deflated. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be terrible. I've only brought over 15 footballs, and I'm going to lose them at this rate, you know. But then 2 kids took them away, and they came back with them repaired the next day. And that was, you know, the kind of resourcefulness of these kids. They were unbelievable. Over the course of the next couple of weeks, we experienced a lot of heavy rain. It meant that some kids actually couldn't train. And I got the story explained to me, because obviously the English was a little bit of a barrier. The kind of common language was football. I tried to set up some drills. The kids, by the way, the standard was unbelievably high, given the facilities and given what they were actually wearing to train in. I couldn't believe the quality of the kids. They were so good. If some of them were in the UK, they would easily be in some of the best academies in the UK. Like the quality of their touch and everything was so good. But yeah, I got the story explained to me that basically if they trained in the rain, they couldn't train again the next day because they didn't have enough clean football kit to basically train 2 days in a row. And that literally, like, I was like, it broke me to hear that. So I was adamant I was going to have all the stuff in my bag was basically getting left there, and I was going to give it to these kids. It also wiped out the Wi-Fi this rain, so the entire town went into a power cut for about 3 days. And so I literally, no Wi-Fi, bear in mind the office was the only place in the whole town that had Wi-Fi. So I was spoiled anyway. But I couldn't obviously charge a phone. I think I had a Kindle with me. So I couldn't do anything when I wasn't coaching. So it was a little bit, I almost felt a little bit isolated, a bit of disconnect, which at the time I struggled with. But I think on reflection, it was probably quite good for me to have that. We had huge crowds every time I trained with the kids. So we only had 22 in the group, but so many more wanted to be involved. But also the charity had to try and keep it to a sensible number for me to manage, but also to benefit the kids and actually for them to get something. I only had a certain amount of equipment to use. And yet there was just always tons of kids watching these sessions. They were just mesmerised. And then one of the little kids, he still to this day melts me. He's probably not going to be so small now, but he was absolutely tiny. And the group were about 12 to 14 years old, generally speaking. So all similar kind of build and heights. But he was like, came up to some of their waists. And I was like, you know, maybe he doesn't need to be in this group because he's probably going to get hurt. And basically what he'd done is he'd lied about his age to get into the group. And then when he was asked about when he basically came clean, he basically admitted that he'd done that, but he was wearing a Celtic top, which I'm a Celtic fan. He was always going to survive that way. And then when he was asked if he should be let to continue, he basically said yes, because I'm very gobas, which is an Amharic word for very clever. And at that point, I was like, right, he's staying. He's absolutely staying in the group. I coached every day, which was great, but that was only for maybe two sessions as well, so 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, because they were on their school holiday, which worked out really well for all of us. One of my other good memories at the time was I did a morning run every day because, again, there was no opportunity for a gym, and I like to think that I try and keep myself fit. I was one of the only, they say, Farangis, which is foreigners, in the entire town, so I did really stand out. And no one really runs with earphones. I mean, there was barely any people with that kind of technology. So I was running my earphones in, and at one point I didn't actually hear them, but I looked to the side and I've got about 5 kids running in bare feet beside me. And at the time I was moving like pretty quickly, I hope, but these kids were running beside me, full speed, bare feet, and trying to hold a conversation with me about, they were just basically testing their English out. And they lasted for about 2 kilometres, like running along, and I was also like, have you not got somewhere to go, guys? But yeah, if you've never seen the movie Ali, where Will Smith plays Muhammad Ali, it felt a little bit like that, maybe not on the same scale, but I did feel like a bit of a celebrity. And then the unfortunate aspect of that 2 weeks was the shipping, so obviously that 50 kilograms of boxes I'd sent over didn't make it out eventually, but not while I was there, so that I had all this extra kit, balls, boots, that I wanted to distribute to these kids that I was working with, and unfortunately, despite multiple backhanded bribes, we were unable to get it out of shipping. It turns out in Ethiopia, it's illegal to bring in used goods because it can damage the economy. So basically, it would stop those kids from potentially going and buying brand new stuff, which obviously none of them were going to do. So I passionately disagreed with this, but that was ultimately a political thing that I had no control over. It was about 2 months later, they managed to finally get out of customs, probably with some of it a little bit less. We had to probably pay off some guys to get that. But yeah, some of those photos are the best I've ever seen. I have seen all those kids with brand new matching team kits. It was amazing. And they're still getting used now, you know, 5 and 6 years later.
So aside from the kind of the negatives of the shipping issues and the briberies paid to get the equipment and the sports kits into Ethiopia, it sounds like, you know, your first experience there was very heartwarming and positive in the ways that you wanted it to be, as you've gone from this highly privileged school with, you know, students that probably want for nothing to meeting children that can't go to their football training if they've trained in the rain because they haven't got enough clothes. It's definitely left a positive, like, mark on you. So you're hooked here into Ethiopia. You like working with Link Ethiopia. What are the next steps?
So yeah, obviously I wanted to go back as soon as I possibly could. So I wanted to really build on that momentum that I had. So I booked to go back the following February, which was February 2014. I built another fundraising page after the success of my first one and thought I could really make a bigger dent into the fundraising, because again, I realised that unfortunately the big thing these guys needed, apart from just my time, and I can only give them so much when I've got a contract in the Middle East to teach for 9 months of the year, what they really needed was money, because they needed to move forward, and even just to give them another football kit so they could train more often. So I had a 10-month fundraising page where I said I would do a new challenge every single month. So I was going to do 10 challenges in 10 months. The final challenge was an Ironman 70.3, which was going to take place in Malaysia. And all the challenges that built up towards that were in between. So I basically was trying to put myself into some kind of physical discomfort in a number of these to try and get people to donate on that basis. Some of our fantastic staff and still very good friends of ours at our school helped with some fundraising race nights, and again they made some huge sums of money because again in Kuwait it's a different culture where you can't, there's no bars and these kind of aspects to for people to spend their money in, so therefore to do it in a race night in somebody's apartment is a good way of doing it. Managed to raise £4,000, so about 40,000 Hong Kong dollars in the 10 months. And then I actually took you with me to see what I was talking about, because obviously I'd raved about it at work for a long time, and obviously you then got the opportunity to see. So we worked with the same football groups, which obviously I love to see the progress that the boys had made. But we also spent some time teaching PE in schools. So maybe you can talk a little bit about some of your experiences that we had.
Well, yeah, firstly, I mean, I think arriving there, like you said, you kind of get that experience at the airport of like, oh my God, what are we doing? And you've got that long drive out to Bishoftu on the cramped taxi. I remember having my knees pretty much under my chin for about an hour and a half, cramped in besides a chicken and five children. But once, like you said, you arrive in Bishoftu and you meet the children, like everything changes. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. I'm very glad that I went to experience it with you. But I also think, like you said, as a teacher, we've been very lucky to work in some very affluent countries and affluent schools. And then to go to this school where you can see children just basically so excited to go to school, but they are wearing their pajamas, they're not wearing shoes, they might not have had a change of clothes for a couple of days, but they are smiling, they want to improve their English, they come running out to pee. I think we had in one PE lesson about 70 children and one ball. And basically the PE teacher was almost like, yeah, you split them and then they just play. And I was like, they play what, 35 versus 35? So we just did some very simple games that we would use as warm-up activities, but they got a chance to develop their English. They were thinking about colours, they were thinking about numbers. And at the end of that day, I remember four of the little girls that walked us all the way back to where we were staying, which was about 30-minute walk away, and they were like, are you coming back tomorrow? Are you coming back tomorrow? And telling them no was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do, because they were devastated that we weren't coming back. And it was just a little bit of a realization that as a teacher, you can have such an impact on people. But these children were so grateful for that time we gave them. And we were probably only there for 2 hours, mm-hmm. I think. Another fantastic experience was the boys you worked with when the coaching of the football. Now, I'm not a great football coach, so I kind of took the opportunity to almost take photos and just step back and watch it and enjoy seeing you coaching them. But I remember when we were walking back from dinner one night, and it gets very, very dark in Bishoftu when the sun's gone. There are very, very minimal streetlights. And from where I've grown up back home, if you were walking in the dark and you saw a group of teenagers walking towards you, it could be quite intimidating. And I remember almost like tapping you on the arm, being like, Callum, there's a big group of people coming towards us. And it actually turned out that it was the entire football team that you've been coaching. And they sang songs to us and walked us home dancing down the street. And to see them like almost being carefree and just so excited to see you out and about, like most students are when they see their teachers around, they're either, you know, shy about it or they're like, oh, hi, there's Mr. Erskine. But these guys, you know, so grateful for your time and what you've given them, that they were singing. I can't remember the exact time, but I do remember that Caleb was in there and my name got shortened to Stefani. So it's like, Caleb, 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 Stefani, Stefani, Stefani. And they walked us all the way home. And I just remember like sleeping so well that night because it was just such a lovely, lovely experience.
You're just so happy.
Yeah, always happy. Like, you know, they don't have a lot. Like, they really don't, but yet they show up when they're supposed to for their training sessions or for school. They might not be in the nicest clothes. They might have walked for an hour to get to where they need to. But they're always happy and they were always grateful for anything, whether it was a coaching session, whether it was saying hello to them. Yeah, it was just a very, very positive place, and I'm very grateful that I got a chance to go. And at the end of that trip, we obviously, that's your second visit, my first visit, you didn't actually go back again until 2017. So can you kind of talk us through what happened from that 2014 trip until the next time you go back in 2017?
Yeah, it went through a kind of period where I was aware that I couldn't go back every single holiday. I was also then between changing jobs and moving country. So by the time we did that, we were actually living in Kazakhstan. I was still maintaining the fundraising, so that was still going quite well. I personally was giving donations every month and still had some active fundraising pages on the side. I did have a kind of, I got to a total of entry of £15,000, which 150,000 Hong Kong dollars for basically a one person fundraiser when I am taking it from like my Facebook friends and contacts I have. I think it was a pretty impressive tally. I'd imagine other people would who fundraise before understand it's not, you've got to have a real something that you're passionate about and people to give donations for. And obviously a lot of people get donations for things like that are absolutely justified, like if maybe somebody's unfortunately ill in some regard and the research to back up the charity that would support them through this illness, that's absolutely fantastic. But for something where people don't actually know these kids, they don't know the project, maybe they just see my photographs and me putting myself into positions that are uncomfortable to try and raise some money, I was really proud of the amount that was the total. My personal donations, it was negotiated that I would basically pay the wages of the head football coach, Tibby, who still I do pay that just now. He has progressed from a youngster in charge of these boys to a young man. I'm very proud to support him for that because he's now on Facebook. I mean, he was on Facebook for maybe a couple of years. Again, Wi-Fi has improved in the town. So when he's got a chance to access that, he is in touch with me quite a lot, sends me updates, sends me photographs of the team. Tibby is actually at university now, so when I first met him, he was only about 15, but I thought he was about 25 when I met him. Like he was the boss, like all these kids listened to him. Yet when I appeared, he would step aside and let me take the session. He would almost be trying to work out what I was doing and learn from it. And he's gone and done his coaching badges, and he really is a great example for those young boys. The overall project, I changed it to something that it was linked still with Link Ethiopia. I still worked closely with them. But I was trying to make my own project called Project Bishoftu, which is the name of the town. And I had these kind of high and mighty plans to build a sporting facility from scratch. Now that might sound kind of outrageous, but having been there a couple of times, I really thought it was something that we could do. But unfortunately, when you make these plans, it's better if you're actually in the country. So asking members of the charity, the members of staff who work for the charity to do that, part of that groundwork for me was asking a lot. I appreciate, and then unfortunately a couple of other issues came to light, so money being one. The costs of construction in Ethiopia are astronomical, like it's unbelievable in itself. That highlights a couple of the political issues. You know, one of the richest men in the world lives in Addis. He works in construction, he's an Ethiopian man, yet all of a sudden when I asked to build a football facility, and when I say a football facility I meant a turf or grass field with like a breeze block changing room, I was getting kind of quoted up in around the 1 million Hong Kong dollars, which, you know, despite my passion for fundraising and for helping these kids, I had no capacity to do that, and that was heartbreaking, that the realization that was going to be outside of my control to do that. So I slightly changed the angle and the focus, and realised, you know, when we were back in the country in 2017, that you can only help so many people. And don't get me wrong, when you're in that town, you want to help them all. You want to help everybody. They're so nice, they're so receptive, so grateful for your time. But at the same time, we are just two people. We can't possibly help every single one of them. And I decided that I was going to put my focus into just the group that I was working with, so just that team. And obviously the teammates might change, a couple of kids might move on to different groups, but generally speaking, my time would be with them. The remaining pot of the money, so all that fundraising money, has kind of been drip-fed into projects with the charity, so the charity are in control of that, but at the same time, I get updates if they're maybe, they ran a big 10-kilometre race just last year, where they were focused on getting girls' participation up, so a lot more girls were getting involved in sport. Tibby actually helps coach one of the girls' teams in the town as well now, and again, all the money is kind of helping support that stuff, and that's, I'm absolutely delighted that that's being used well, because as long as the money is going towards getting young people involved in sport, it doesn't have to be football, and it doesn't just have to be boys, obviously, either. I kind of continue to support Tibby, as I've mentioned, and the group that I coached. So when I went back in 2017 to see those boys who had been, you know, maybe as young as 12 up to 14, and I showed up in 2017 and these guys were like, some of them had like facial hair and they were like 17, they were absolute monsters. I was like, wow. And yet the same, you know, with when I show up, they're on time, they're polite, they're quiet, they listen. Their English obviously has all become a lot better, so I'm able to run some more complex drills. Obviously, their football ability has improved hugely as well with the help of Tibby coaching them. And it was again, amazing experience. Every time I got the chance to coach, it was amazing. The other bits either side of the coaching were frustrating because I realised I was getting roadblock after roadblock in terms of trying to move the project forward. With COVID and the worldwide economy, the and less donations overall into charities, Link Ethiopia have actually had to merge with another charity. They're now called Together We Learn Ethiopia. So again, their focus is on education. Obviously a massive part of it. They do such a good job for schools in Ethiopia. They help build fresh water wells in schools so that kids can also drink fresh water when they're there. Improved toilet blocks and sanitization within schools that are all government schools, just to help that process for them and make the experience beneficial for the kids. So again, sport and PE is not necessarily at the forefront of the charity's mind. And again, as they've maybe cut costs, my project is not necessarily top of the pile. So I've had to do a lot of it through Tibby directly, which has been maybe more difficult with the communication, but we've certainly made some progress. So just highlight the charities, the sort of the challenges of charity work to me, especially when you're not in the country. Yeah, so I'm aware that there's only so much I can do as one person, but working with Tibby now closely, hopefully we can keep the progress moving forward.
Yeah, I think being a part of that trip again to 2017, it was quite difficult to see you experience those frustrations in realising that the plans you had for Project Bishoftu were probably a lot further away than you ever thought they would be, when we obviously found out, like, you know, a breeze block cost a ridiculous amount of money when we're so used to thinking that it's easily accessible. It was quite hard to sit there and see you have to almost rethink your plan. But then again, when you got to spend time with the boys that you've coached and Tibby, you could see that, well, that was probably the best way to move forward for yourself. So from this point forward, you've now reevaluated what Project Bishoftu will mean. You are thinking about just focusing on the football, coaching boys, whether it's the girls as well that come along, but expanding that, I suppose, and obviously helping Tibby as much as possible. What's the future? What goes on from now?
Yeah, so obviously everything's probably down on a smaller scale. COVID has put the kind of barriers up for a few things, but I'm hoping to support Tibby through his coaching badges. He's shown a real enthusiasm. He's at university studying sports science, as far as I'm aware, or a variation of that degree, but is very keen to maintain his coaching as he thinks that's maybe a good career path to go down. And so I'm happy to try and help him through that process. as best as I can. I mean, again, Addis in Ethiopia is not maybe a prominent place for coaching badges to take place, but we're looking to try and help him as much as we can. Within that, then he can obviously help create a new cycle. So obviously, if he can get a new batch of young people to get involved, obviously the group that I worked with are now not so small, and our young men, so are going to naturally move on to other things. But again, if he can get some of them involved in the coaching aspect, then that momentum and that cycle can continue, and we start again with a new young group of young people. I've not given up hope of going back again, but I'm acutely aware of the challenges, and I want to be realistic. I don't want to go there and be kind of really disappointed again with the amount that I can do and the impact I can make. You know, fundamentally, the biggest donation you can make is that of your time. So I am aware of that. I am very aware that if I go back, even with empty pockets and no equipment for them, they would still be delighted to see me and delighted to be part of a coaching group. Obviously, they do love the financial support and the equipment, but it's the time they love. They love being coached. They love being taught. And obviously, so do I. I love being part of that process. It was so beneficial for me as well. The language barrier is definitely there. So online communication and provisions have improved in the town, but this isn't something that's maybe sustainable. So it's really a place, if you want to make an impact, you've got to be there. So I think I've got to be aware of that as well in terms of the big picture and thinking about what I can do in the future.
Yeah, definitely true. Obviously, having experienced Bishofto itself, it's a place that you could easily see yourself wanting to stay there, mm-hmm. to try and help as many people as you can, but you also have to be realistic in terms of the amount of people that you can help and how you can do it to the best of your ability. So as we come to a close on this episode and this story, what would you say are any like takeaways for our listeners today?
My big one would be like just try and get out there and make an impact for people that are less fortunate for you. So, you know, while I've done something maybe on this scale, it doesn't have to be that scale, but yeah, people that even that you know of, or even in the city or the town that you live in, there's definitely people less fortunate, and just try to help them out and make an impact in their lives in a positive way. And it doesn't always have to be frequent, it can be infrequent, but again, it's such a beneficial process for both. You feel better about yourself, you get a lot out of it, but obviously so do they, because you're trying to help bridge that gap between you. And obviously, I love to talk about this project. I love to talk about my experience in Ethiopia. So if anybody's got any questions they would like to ask me at a different time, or you know, I would be absolutely delighted to shed some more light on this, because yeah, it's something I really still feel passionate about and love to talk about.
I suppose also, if after listening to this, any of our students or other listeners have any ideas, or any, you know, they're interested in being involved, they could also reach out to you with any potential fundraising ideas, mm-hmm. or other aspects that we could look into. That would be greatly appreciated. Well, thank you very much for your time today and sharing that experience with us of your time in Ethiopia and your project Bishofto. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Nattering with the Knights. If you want to make sure that you don't miss any future episodes, then please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please reach out to your PE teacher if you have any feedback or ideas about topics you would like to see and hear about in the future. In the meantime, have a great week, and we will see you next time.